This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Bones, Boyd and Cottle, the physician archetype in speculative fiction. Madeleine came up with this one.
Yes, I did.
I think her mind might be on health at the moment.
Forewarning to all of our listeners, yeah, slightly high.
I think you need to give them more context than that.
Yeah, I should add that that's on legally prescribed drugs. I just had surgery on my knee, because some of you may remember that January last year I tore the ligaments in my knee, and so I had to have some surgery to kind of repair it and repair sort of the area around it. And that's how I spent my Tuesday. And it was hell on earth. It was really bad. So yes, having been under general anesthesia before and had no problems at all, I wasn't expecting to react quite as badly as I did. It was not fun. And I'm back home now. I'm doing okay. But the drugs have a powerful kick. And I may not be as coherent and as beautifully articulate as I usually am. So Jules is probably going to have to lead on this. But yeah, I was thinking about doctors as I was lying there in something akin to a fever dream, kind of in between consciousness, whilst doctors rushed around me and sort of suggested things and reminded me to breathe and other things like that. And I was thinking about doctors and about their role in fiction, because in most, especially in the sort of the epic sagas, you have to have the healer character. And they're not usually the main character. They are a support character. And I guess that's probably the first person we spoke to. We called him up. Was Dr. McCoy, or Bones, from the Star Trek fandom. And I did think of Bones, first of all, because the clinic where I was having the operation did look very sci-fi. Like there was blue lighting and it was very white, and I kept expecting a tricorder to be pushed into my face. So I did start thinking about Bones and Bones as a character. So that's where this episode was born. Yes.
There you go. We get them from all sorts of sources.
So I guess we should start with Bones and Bones as a character.
We can start with the Doctor character from Star Trek, because there's lots of different ones. There is.
I'm almost certain that all of the Doctor characters in Star Trek are just really done with everybody. They're always sarcastic.
Not Beverly Crusher.
They're all grumpy. Not okay. I don't remember that one though. But of the Doctor characters I remember from Star Trek, of the few Star Treks that I watched, they're pretty much always kind of ugh, and they're constantly worried and you know, prematurely grey.
I think that only really applies to Dr. McCoy. I mean, you've got the Doctor character from Voyager, and he's actually a hologram. He was supposed to be like emergency first aid. And the Doctor gets, the actual Doctor, the crew member, gets killed fairly early on in the series. So he's activated all the time, and his programming starts to change. So, you know, he's a hologram, but he's basically AI, yeah. So he's superior. And yes, he's very snarky and has a superiority complex and all the rest of it, but a lot of that is to do with the fact that he's experimental software who isn't supposed to be switched on all the time. Beverly Crusher, the female doctor from the Next Generation, is, I would say, she actually has like ideal bedside manner for doctors. The only time I started to lose patience with her was when they started doing a romance arc between her and Jean-Luc Picard. It's just like, no, that doesn't work for me.
Stop it.
And the doctor, and it's awful, I can't remember off the top of my head who he's called now, and he's one of my favourite characters, so my brain is working fabulously well today. But from Deep Space Nine, which is probably the finest of all the Star Trek series, he's got...
Oh, careful, you're gonna...
No,
people
well, maybe.
Are gonna come find you.
You may throw beanbags at me, that's fine. He's lovely. I mean, but then again, he's a genetically modified human. He doesn't know this to start with when you follow his character arc. But he started off as at quite a disadvantage, and then he finds out later on, once he's qualified as the doctor on the space station, that he's actually genetically modified. And that's against the law. So, but generally, he's a nice person.
Well, there you go then. You've contradicted me in every level.
Well, I think it's because you're only thinking about bones. You're not really thinking about
no,
doctors.
I was. There was another doctor, but I mean, to be honest, your knowledge of Star Trek is far greater than mine. So I bow to your superior Trekkiness.
In all fairness, I remember the original airing of the Next Generation.
Jesus Christ.
I remember the arguments between old Trekkies and new Trekkies about whether the Next Generation contravened canon or not, and whether we should all ignore it. I mean, I was about 8, but I do remember.
Jesus. Okay, going back to but original Star Trek and sort of looking at Bones as a character. He was an interesting character because I think in a lot of ways he defied... Well, I mean, the Star Trek in general was all about defying the expectations of the what was then the modern day. So, for instance, the fact that they had both men and women on board, people of colour, you know, it was always kind of sort of moving away from that. But looking at Bones as a character, he is interesting because he's a Southern gentleman.
Yeah.
He's from the South. He's quite... crusty. He doesn't want to be there.
No.
He definitely doesn't want to be there. He's obviously deeply caring though, but you know, despite the sort of this crusty and the fact that he is a very one should say a clinical character, he's a very feeling character, and he is sort of really the kind of the heart of the dynamic between himself, Kirk, and the Green Goblin. I mean, Spock.
I think that's the thing, though, because you've got him as a Southern gentleman, and you've got him making things like you pointy-eared hobgoblin to Spock, which is potentially quite a racist thing to say.
Yes, it is. It's true. I didn't think of it like that.
Absolutely fine with Uhura, of course, but...
Yeah, he's fine with Uhura. He takes orders from Uhura, which is pretty cool, especially given the time. But, yeah...
I think in a lot of ways it's a superiority thing with Spock, because Spock is, well, Vulcans are generally superior physical beings. They're a lot stronger, they tend to be a lot more intelligent, they live a lot longer, and they are in full possession of their faculties because, you know, they have this ability to suppress their emotions. They've had long-term conditioning. And that's anathema
yeah.
to everything that McCoy stands for.
Yeah. But McCoy is an interesting character. He, despite being quite crusty, he is very generous, actually. Deeply feeling. And he is the kind of doctor that you want, because he has a certain authority when it comes to, you know, when it's in his domain, he takes charge. And he does take charge. And he's dealing with people who are very difficult to take charge of.
I think that's part of the grumpiness, aside from the fact that A, he doesn't really want to be there, B, he's got Kirk as his captain, and Kirk's kind of like, yeah, we probably shouldn't go down on that planet, we've been ordered not to, but hey, let's do it anyway. And he's like, Kirk, no. And Kirk's going, Kirk, yes.
Yes.
Kirk, no. Kirk, yes. Oh, what was yeah. that, McCoy? I'm already in the shuttle.
But I'm gonna do it anyway, is the... The epitome of what Kirk is. Yeah, it's basically just like a, well, they've told us that the planet is potentially dangerous, but I've heard there's a beautiful woman down there. Kirk, you shouldn't go down there. Yeah, you're right, Bones. Really? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, where are you right now? I'm in the shuttle. Damn it, Kirk!
Kirk's like, I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of how awesome I am.
I'm too busy teaching an alien woman how to love. Sorry, that's. I thought that was Kirk's.
Meanwhile, McCoy is there, sitting there in sick bay, thinking, "And how many red shirts are we going to lose this time?"
Seriously, I like the idea that actually the red shirts they lose aren't even red shirts, as in they're about to go down on the planet and someone hands them a red shirt and they're like, oh no. Oh no. They've assigned me for death duty. Yeah, only red shirt who's safe is Scotty.
Yeah.
Unbelievably. Anyway, I did like him as a character. And I don't know, and you'll probably argue with me, but so far as I can see, he was quite iconic as the sort of the trendsetter of the crusty, oh yeah, no, you know, don't pay attention to me, I'm just a doctor character that has started to appear a lot more in other kind of epic storylines.
Yeah, I think he fed into an archetype that was already partially formed and then shaped the archetype from within. So yeah, I do actually agree with that, because certainly if you've got a science fiction off the peg space opera type thing, you tend to have a character like that, and he's very nearly always connected with healing of some kind.
Yeah, but he is a great character and we like him for his crabbiness. Though, you know, we would not want a crappy character who actually you know, at our bedside. But that said, doctors are quite sarcastic people.
Well, I mean, I can understand that. I've been worked with quite a lot of them. And there are times when you get it's catching sarcasm as well. As in, you spend like a couple of months in their company and in the sort of situation that you work with doctors in. And yeah, if you don't wash out immediately because it's just too hard going, and a lot of people do, then you do get to the point where, okay, this is funny, it's disgusting, but it's funny because it's disgusting, or to the stage of, oh, well, I suppose we'll all just cut our feet off kind of thing, that sort of level of fatalism.
Yeah.
The only way you can keep going, if you don't develop that sort of tough outer membrane, then you can't be there just being a really, really open, caring person, or certainly most people can't, and that can't be all you can be, because it'll kill you really, really quickly.
Yes, I think it will. I just remember before I went into surgery, I had sort of the two doctors and the nurse and stuff were sort of prepping me. They were asking me questions. They were just being very friendly, and they said, oh, so what do you do? And I was like, I'm a writer, and I lecture at university. And I said, I'd ask what you guys do, but I guess that's fairly obvious. And without a hesitation, without a beat, the guy who just stuck an IV into my hand was there like, well, I'm the cook, he cleans. And we don't even know who she is. She's on bail. And I was like, that's great. Just before I fall unconscious.
Yeah, that sounds about right, actually. There is definitely a level... I mean, and it is very funny. You have to pitch to your audience in that situation. But there is a level where you can go too far. Like, I won't go into detail, but there was... is particularly amongst surgeons I found, where they detach themselves from human emotion to the point where they will say things that are really inappropriate and not realise they're inappropriate. For example, speaking of a body whereby they had to do an autopsy quite quickly to find out what's gone wrong, then calling down the corridor to the woman who was waiting, did she want the organs put back in the body?
Oh,
this actually happened in front of me. my mouth was hanging down on my chest because I'm quite tactless. I admit I can be quite tactless, but that was so far beyond tactless that, you know, I was like, I can't believe I've just heard that. And if I told you the rest of the circumstances of that situation, it would sound even worse. It was really, really awful.
I'm not going to go into it.
But yeah, so there definitely is a level where you should not be going, in my opinion. But black humour in hospitals does happen, and there are things now that I think, now I don't work in that environment, that's probably quite inappropriate, and I don't think I should repeat it on a podcast. But at the time, it was funny, and it kept you going, and no disrespect was ever meant, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because if you think about what you have to do, in you see the absolute worst and best of humanity in a hospital, you really do. So I kind of see where it's developed. I see where it came from in myself, and I come from a family that pretty much have all worked for the NHS for long years. So we all speak like that amongst ourselves, and no one thinks anything of it. It's only when we speak to other people, it's a bit sort of, you're being weird, kind of thing.
That's not appropriate.
Stop talking in acronyms. Stop talking about in medical terminology. No one's got a clue what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I did like, because, you know, I think up until that point, you had seen some very sort of nice doctors. Well, I mean, there were two kind of doctors in the fiction that you saw. They were the really scary, stern ones who had no sense of humour at all. Or the very, very gentle, very, very empathetic, very, very kind doctors who were always sort of constantly by your side. Neither are particularly true. It's not to say that doctors can't be empathetic. I find that nurses are very empathetic people.
Yes, although I have known a few nurses that go the opposite way as well, and I genuinely think, what on earth drew you to nursing? Because in some ways, nursing is as difficult, if not more difficult, than being a doctor.
Yeah, I agree. I have incredible respect for nurses, especially the nurses who took care of me, because I was a pain. But I do, I have incredible respect for nurses. I think they're amazing people. And they have to be very, very patient, but they also have to be, you know, they have to have that authority, because patients panic. And what patients tend to need isn't someone panicking with them. What patients need is someone who's going to firmly say, no, stop it. You know, like, you're like, I'm about to vomit up my own insides. No, you're not. No, you're not going to do that. That's not physically going to happen. And they need someone in authority who's gentle, but also who is no nonsense.
Yeah.
And nurses kind of have to hold that line. Doctors just disappear really quick. The surgeon comes in. My surgeon was a great guy, but he came in. He was just there like, hello, all right, I'll see you in the operating room. Bye. And left. I was like, bye.
I have to say, it's a relatively recent, I say recent in the last few decades thing, where they come and introduce themselves.
Yeah. Which I think is nice. If someone's going to be cutting into me, I'd like to see their face and remember it, put it into my memory.
In my experience, you have to be a bit peculiar to be a surgeon. You have to be a bit peculiar to be a dentist, to be honest. But
yeah.
There's something about the mindset, and you kind of want them to be that way, because you don't want somebody there going, I'm cutting into this person's skull. Oh my God, I'm cutting into their skull. Ah. You just kind of want them to be looking at it as though it's mechanical rather than biological.
Yeah.
It's the same with dentists, to be honest. The last thing you want is someone panicking when they've got a drill in your mouth.
Yeah. My surgeon was really fascinated by the fact I was writing. He's like, so you just create things. Like, I don't write very interesting things. He said, I guess you probably want me to be quite boring. I'm like, yeah, I really don't want you to be creative with fixing me. Please don't be creative. But yeah, it's they're odd people, and so it's nice that we have kind of diverse sort of characters when it comes to sort of doctors nowadays, but I like the idea of the surgeon or the doctor who's just a bit of a twat, to be honest. Don't know if I can say that. I just did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a big... You know what? That's a segue into something we don't want to get into. Cutting what? Myself off at the source. Oh, the use of the word twat. Whether it's sexist or not. Blah, 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 okay, blah, okay. Blah. I don't think so.
Okay, all right. That's... But, you know, I think of House. I loved House.
Yeah, I mean, I've got...
Did you used to watch House?
I've seen a couple of episodes. I've always meant to really watch it because I think I'd find it interesting. But I think his attitude would probably mean I would have punched him in the face several times.
Yeah, I mean, the problem was that he got worse, which was a bit annoying. Like, to begin with, he was actually kind of tolerable. And then, of course, it got a little bit over the top. And it was a bit like, actually, how can anyone stand this person anymore?
So they sort of blunderized him.
Yeah, basically. Although Hugh Laurie is an amazing performer, but it was a very interesting character. And the thing with him is that it's obviously a Sherlock Holmes retelling. And he was created as that sort of slightly not completely with it character, but brilliant and very, very smart and troubled. And so in that sense that he was absolutely fascinating. But once again, there was this kind of this general pull away from bureaucracy in a lot of ways, which is kind of what Sherlock Holmes is about. But, you know, it's about, you see in a lot of sort of modern TV shows, which is that you have the loose cannon and people allow him to be the loose cannon because he gets the results. And that's only really allowed in fiction, let's be honest, okay? Because hospital rules and regulations are there usually for a reason. And House always nearly kills his patients before he cures them. So.
Yes. Yeah. I'd say one of my favourite doctors is the doctor from Battlestar Galactica, the reboot. And that's Dr. Cottle.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes him interesting is he's a guy who's literally about to retire as a doctor, if he isn't retired already. He's well into his 60s, if not a bit older. He smokes like a chimney. He smokes like a chimney around his patients, but by that point, the human race is pretty close to being extinct, so it's kind of like, meh. And he has to deal with the fact that in a fleet of something like 50,000, he is the only real doctor. There are medics, and there are nurses and things, but the number of people they managed to evacuate from Earth was so small, he's the only real doctor. And they've only got primitive medical equipment, because the Cylons attacked first with a computer virus that wiped everything out. So all the really, you know, they couldn't get away on the really fancy ships and things like that with up to spec technology and medical equipment. So he's only got the basic stuff, which is, you know, what Battlestar Galactica is. It's an anachronistic ship that was being turned into a museum, and it turned out to be the last bastion of humanity. And yes, he's very sarcastic, and he's very sort of fatalistic. He is very fatalistic. But when you think that he's like, okay, somehow I've got to patch up what remains of humanity. I'm never going to get to retire. I'm going to die in this white coat.
It
doesn't mean that he doesn't care. It's like his last retreat is behind this thick facade of sarcasm and grumpiness, because they're not sure that the human race isn't pretty much doomed at that point.
Yeah. Well, what else is he supposed to do? Yeah.
And what's really interesting is when they start realising that the Cylons... you know, guys, if you haven't seen Battlestar Galactica by now, I'm going to spoil you, but what have you been doing? Seriously. When they start realising that the Cylons actually now look like humans, there are human version Cylons. When they capture some of them and they end up injured, he treats them just as well as he does the humans. He argues for their rights as living creatures as well.
Yeah. He's
obviously a very compassionate person, very balanced, not blinded by the hatred. He just treats the problem in front of him.
Yeah. That's another thing about Doctor characters and what they kind of actually represent. Usually, whenever they're sort of put into situations where it is this kind of this battle or there's this otherness, and it's the representation of actually all living beings are worthy of care. Doesn't matter which side they are, doesn't matter who they are. They deserve compassion and they deserve treatment.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because, of course, this is in a place where, you know, if that creature were not injured, if it was standing, it would be shot. But because it's injured, I like it because that's actually something which we're seeing a lot of. I can't actually at the moment, and you probably will be able to think of a doctor character who willingly says, "I'm not treating him. He's a monster." I mean, can you think of a doctor character who refuses to treat?
See, I can't off the top of my head. I know I've read the situation in books, but usually it's a more minor doctor character and they're refusing so that the more junior doctor can say, okay, well, I'll treat them then.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's to highlight the ascent of the hero rather than the fact that that particular doctor's a bad person, if you like.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of Samwell Tarly in Game of Thrones, the latest season.
Yeah.
And you've seen it, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Spoilers for everyone else, but he's the one who treats and cures Jorah Mormont.
Yes.
Which is pretty cool, actually.
Yep, that is quite cool.
And it's interesting because he almost becomes a bit of a medic character. I mean, he was a sort of a bookkeeper, but his skills have kind of... Sam as a character is always about helping people. And he's actually sort of quite... He would be quite apt to be that medic person up until the point that he probably doesn't have the guts, or not the guts, but he probably would struggle to lose people.
Yeah, definitely. There's something fundamentally quite optimistic in his character,
and
which sort of makes him an ideal Meister, makes him an ideal new blood Meister, because the old Meisters are all, you know, quite old and set in their ways.
Yeah.
So they've got the learning and everything, but they think they already know what's coming, and to be honest, they've got no more clue than anybody else has.
Yeah. And they're very, very set in their ways, and they're not budging, which is actually kind of to the detriment of learning in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Okay, so along with doctor characters, you've also got the healer type character. And the healer nearly always is female.
Particularly
in books. So, for example, going back to Juliet Marillier, which we've mentioned before, Daughter of the Forest, Sorica is, you know, she's very, very young for it, but she is a healer. And, you know, there's circumstances that you find out from her family and from her bloodline later on in the series, that there's a reason she's got an aptitude for that. Her daughter, Liadin, in the second book, follows the same path. And, you know, there's always a healer at Seven Waters is what ultimately happens.
Yeah.
So that's always quite... It's an interesting facet that... I mean, I think it feeds into the whole cunning woman type thing.
I think it also feeds into that healers are kind of always more like nurses in some ways. Because healers are unanimous with the idea of caring and gentleness. And that's possibly actually because of actually how, when we think of magic healing, it seems to be more gentle. It doesn't involve cutting into people. This is obviously not true. I think healing would probably still involve quite a bit of icky stuff. But healers also tend to be... concerned not with just the sort of the healing of the body, but the healing of the mind as well. And that's something which is put on women and female characters more often than not.
Yeah, it is a more holistic approach. I mean, an interesting one to look at, and I know we've mentioned Outlander before, is obviously Claire Fraser.
Mm.
And she obviously was a combat nurse during World War II and ends up in Scotland in the 18th century, as you do.
Yeah,
and she makes her way. She forges a place for herself by being able to use her more advanced medical skills. And then, obviously, she leaves. I don't know if you've read the books or you've watched the latest season. I haven't watched the latest season yet, but I have read the books. she basically leaves for 20 years and then goes back again. And in that time, she has qualified as a surgeon. Obviously, yeah, in our time. And that's really interesting as well, because it's really being sort of a herbalist or a herbwife and a healer and a nurse and then a doctor and then a surgeon, you know, they're very, very different medical professions. So being able to combine them all would be quite an unusual thing to be able to do.
But, yeah.
You know, they're not interchangeable. You wouldn't set a surgeon to be somebody's nurse. You just wouldn't. And you wouldn't necessarily pick a nurse and ask them to operate on somebody's knee, for example.
Hopefully. No, unless you were desperate.
Well, let's just say apocalypse scenario, and you've got no other sort of medical capability, and you needed something amputated. I'd have a go if I absolutely had to, but I'd rather pass it over to an actual surgeon.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. It's always in the apocalypse. They're like, we have a nurse, or we have the vet.
Well, yeah, you'd go with the vet, wouldn't you? Or you'd go with a dentist. You'd go with someone who's used to taking shit off. I mean, I know where everything goes and I know what you need to do theoretically, but I wouldn't suggest that I was the best person to do it.
No.
The aftercare, maybe.
Assistance, possibly.
Yeah, and I have done that. And once again, we're back into stuff I can't really talk about on air.
You've led a very interesting life, Jules.
Yes. I'm trying to think of something to say that doesn't involve making a joke about bodily fluids, but brains keep going.
Gotta do it. It happened. Because my healer character, because I've got a healer character, is actually male. In fact, both of my healer characters are male. Within the Sons of Thestian, you have Lord Edwin, who's the head of the healing sect, who are the Magi. And they are basically doctors, they're physicians, and yeah, he's the head of them. And within that, they will have people who specialise in different sort of things.
Yeah.
Now, he has the most skill of all of them, but he still does things like house calls, and he's there, he does everything, basically, because he's the best. At the intricate stuff, but when it comes to who's going to attend to the king and stuff like that, they just think we want the best, we want the oldest guy on the job, the one who's done everything and has been through all of the process and stuff like that. And it takes, of all of the major occupations, becoming a healer takes the longest amount of time. So he's in the first book, and he's quite a compassionate, very loyal person who is quite ambitious with what he wants to do, and he's very much about the embetterment of everybody around him, and he gets frustrated when he feels useless because he wants to be able to cure everything. That's what he wants. So he's very frustrated with Zachary a lot of the time, because he wants to help Zachary, and Zachary is not very good at being helped. But it's in his blood. It's in his very soul and being to be a healer, to be a physician. It's what he's all about, because he's incredibly caring, and he's incredibly invested in the wellness of the people around him. And then you have Boyd. I'm going to ask you first, what's your impression of Boyd? Because obviously he's the Neve physician. So, like, do you think he's suited to the role?
He's got a really odd bedside manner, but perhaps that's because of who his patients usually are. And also there's the whole of him being basically an indentured servant thing.
Yes. Boyd is an interesting character, because really he's not suited to being a physician at all, if I'm honest. He doesn't have the patience. Doctor joke there. Doesn't have the patience. See what I did? He doesn't have the patience to deal with people, which is fine, because actually he's dealing with Catchy, and to be honest, they heal very quickly. They do as they're told, usually. And he really doesn't have to deal with them so much as patients. But he really doesn't have the temperament to be able to to be a physician. He's not good at loss, which is why actually him being around other humans is probably not a great idea, and him treating other humans is not a great idea, because they are they're too stressful, and he gets stressed very, very quickly. So actually, but Boyd is absolutely fascinated by the human body. And if he was able to sort of choose his profession in the modern day, he would be a mortician, probably.
Yeah, I can see that fitting slightly better.
Yeah.
You can't lose someone who's already dead, for example.
Yeah, because, yeah, it would be about that. He's fascinated by bodies and the dead body and the way that sort of bodies function. But he doesn't actually have the emotional kind of fortitude to be able to deal with living patients, because he doesn't want that kind of the word
responsibility.
Exactly. So he's the best physician they've got. He's very good at his job, but he's totally unsuited to it in every single way. And that's why I love writing him as a character.
There's something in pantheons of healer gods and goddesses, and something that's really interesting is that a lot of them have healing either as a secondary attribute or an equal attribute with something else, and the two things wouldn't seem to go very well together. For example, you've got the Morrigan, who is the goddess of slaughter, death, and war, and also healing.
Yeah.
And
because when she's finished the slaughtering and the death,
if you've survived, she'll patch it. Sekhmet, the Egyptian lioness-headed goddess of war and slaughter, is also the goddess of healing.
You also have, within sort of Irish mythology? Good, yes. Mythology, and I'm going to say this name wrong, Dianchecht?
Dianchecht,
thank you. Who is an interesting character, because he was the sort of the healer of the Tuatha De Danann. And he got very jealous of his own son, who managed to achieve a feat that Dianchecht hadn't, and that was to replace someone's hand with flesh,
yeah,
rather than a prosthetic. And so he actually murdered his own son.
Yeah. Professional jealousy, it's not your thing.
there's professional jealousy, and then there's murdering your own child, which I think sort of takes it to another level, really, to be honest. But you don't really think of healers as murderers.
Well,
and yet, yeah, when you look at sort of the old kind of, the old version, they are. The death and healing are so intrinsically linked. It's not even funny. It can't be coincidence, because it occurs in so many different mythologies.
Yes, that's actually something I've kind of mostly unintentionally tapped into when I wrote the Oath and Crown books with Matthew Willis.
Yeah.
Althea, she's not a good candidate as a marriage prospect for various reasons, but she's extremely intelligent. And one of her skills is herb lore and healing and surgery, and you can't be a really good healer particularly with plants, because plants aren't very forgiving if you get them wrong, without a really strong understanding of poisons, for example.
Yeah.
And I won't spoil the story or anything in case anyone wants to read it, but she does, Elgifa herself makes the point that she's never understood why people denigrate poison as the weapon of women and cowards, because there is as much art to properly administering a poison so you don't get caught as there is to learning how to use a sword, for example.
Mm.
And there's a few interesting political developments where she obviously has to use her skills. I won't say she deliberately ever poisons anyone, but once again, you've got healing and death again in the same package, and you can't have one without the other. And if you think back to some of the others that we've mentioned Claire Fraser, we've mentioned Soraka and Leiden, and both and all three of them at some point during their own character arcs have had to administer death, even as a sort of merciful thing, because they could not save their patient.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very interesting. Well, with regards to poison, there was it was actually Agatha Christie, was it she worked at a pharmacy or as a nurse or something like that? And that's how she always knew so much about poison.
That would make sense. I actually don't know. The only thing I really know about Agatha Christie is she disappeared for 2 days and still nobody knows where she went. Not even her.
Well, I think she knew.
No, apparently she didn't. She was in a fugue state.
Yeah, I've sort of heard about that. And I think that... Well, anyway, we're not going to talk about Agatha Christie and her weirdness in general. And what she was hoping and wanting. But yes, it's interesting. And of course, yeah, people forget that the poison and healing are together, and death and healing do go hand in hand. And actually the best medicine, that's wrong, because the best medicine isn't a good release, but it could be argued that the best doctors and the best healers know when to end their patient's suffering.
Yeah. Or are open-minded enough to listen when the patient's statement. To be honest, I would say that having, seen and assisted and treated a lot of people with various different things, there comes a point when you know somebody isn't, their will, whatever, has been turned towards dying rather than living.
Yeah.
And, there's no shame in that. There is a point where someone cannot physically, mentally or emotionally fight on anymore. I completely agree with that. As somebody who has spent, all the years since her early teens learning about plants and herbal medicines and things, it's really, you don't have to be looking too hard to find poison. My dad started teaching me when I was a little girl because we used to take long walks and he would point out plants that were poisonous to me. Not because he
Why
wanted
am
me
I
to be
not poisonous. Surprised.
He didn't want me to become a poisoner. He just didn't want me to eat anything poisonous or touch anything poisonous. And some of them are skin contact. You get a little bit on your skin, you could be in a lot of trouble. And it sort of awoke this fascination of this living world inside plants that most people are just ignorant of. It's just green stuff for them. And
yeah.
Then I sort of looked at some old, I suppose, you'd call them grimoires, actually. I actually found a recipe for flying ointment. I've obviously never tried it, and I don't intend to, but the stuff...
What is flying ointment?
During sabbats with certain medieval witchcraft practices, witches were supposed to be able to make somebody believe they were flying, or, make themselves... It was a use of plants as a sort of recreational drug, if you like. And you made
right.
an ointment out of this stuff and rubbed it on your skin. And quite often they use the broomstick as well because of it being a fertility symbol. And it would probably give you some quite interesting psychedelic trips. Mm. And I wouldn't be at all surprised with what went into it. And I'm surprised so many of them survived. So they must have been really accurate with their dosages.
I'm very curious now. Message me later. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I barely trust myself to cook. There's no way I'm going to try and brew.
Well, yeah, there's various techniques because you can make an infusion with one plant, and if you make a decoction with it, it makes completely different medicine. So it's all that sort of knowledge as well. I've always found
yeah.
it fascinating. And obviously, my grands had a lot of knowledge on the subject, so I sort of plumbed their knowledge. And then years later, when we inherited papers and things from my grandmothers that they'd held on to. All through their family, found out on one side that my grandmother's father used to be what they called a horse leech. So he'd make up these herbal medicines and things, and he'd heal the horses because no one could afford a vet. So, and they were all quite effective things. They're old treatments that aren't necessarily used so much now, but the certain holistic vets and things will still use these concoctions. So that was all fascinating.
Yeah.
So when I said I come from
That's
a family
very,
of medical
cool.
people, I really do come from a family of medical people.
That is very, very cool, actually. That's very cool indeed. Okay, then. All right. So let's go back in time. Let's just go back in time. I didn't have a point to that. I just meant let's go back in time.
Okay. 18th century?
Let's go back in time because you mentioned them. Let's talk a little bit about those wise women. And we've obviously touched down on them before because we've talked about witches and witchcraft and sort of the whole kind of relationship between them. But If we compare how we write healers now and what healers were back then and what it meant to be a healer, it's quite interesting. Because actually we talked about the fact that healing now, when we think of healers, we think of a lot less nitty sort of nitty gritty. It's a lot more kind of touchy feely. There isn't really that much more blood involved. There isn't that much more surgery involved. That probably wasn't particularly true of the healers and the wise women, who were treating sickly people in the village, especially unwanted pregnancies.
I mean, I think one thing to make a distinction with here is you obviously had your cunning women who had the genuine knowledge of herbs, and they might be the only person in the village who could actually read as well. And then you had your cunning women who perhaps weren't cunning in that way, but they were canny in the way of the fair folk. So they were seen as spiritual interceders between humankind and the fair folk, because it was believed that the fair folk called all afflictions. So, for example, if you had a stroke, the reason it's called a stroke was you were thought to have been touched by a fairy. Stroke. And that's what caused the palsy. And so, I mean, that was a thing. So
I'm glad
some,
you brought up fairies.
yes. Well, you know, when if you think about being really, really ill, it's frightening if you don't know what's going on. Lack of knowledge is very frightening, and if it's your own body betraying you, it can be really quite scary. And if I mean, you've got no. We're reason makers as humans, so we will try to make a reason. And if you've got no better reason, then I suppose you blame the fair folk.
Don't know what happened, blamed the fairies.
What's interesting is there are such records as exist. For example, if you were to take 19th century Ireland, suggest that some of the remedies by these uneducated, cunning women that didn't involve known folklore, known folk herbs and folk medicines, but actually involved things that seemed quite arbitrary, actually did work, which suggests that the placebo effect was very, very strong.
I want to talk about mention honey, because honey is something which is attributed, you know, honey and cream and milk and stuff like that is attributed a lot to the fair folk and stuff like that. But honey itself is absolutely excellent when it comes to healing. Because it's an antiseptic, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And it can actually, putting honey on a wound can actually stop it getting infected and can actually really help with the healing, which I just find interesting. And obviously that a lot of the traditionally sort of traditional substances, trees, plants, which are attributed again to fairies, are in onto themselves poisons and genuine healing potions that would have actually made a difference.
Yeah, definitely. There's I don't know if you've ever read Cole Pepper's Complete Herbal. Possibly
No.
not, because I'm a complete nerd, obviously I have read it. That dates back to the 16th century, but a lot of the things in there are actually accurate. But one of the most famous things he said was, "A little poison makes a powerful medicine. A lot of medicine makes a powerful poison." So, and it's a very, very good rule if you're going to deal with. I'm not suggesting people go and experiment with herbs or anything in any capacity, but if you're interested in that sort of thing, it's a good thing to bear in mind.
That's really, really is interesting, actually.
And what I sort of have a nostalgic affection for Cole Pepper's Complete Herbal, even though, you know, it's probably a few hundred years out of date, is the fact he lists all the affiliations of the planets, the gods, and when you should try and pick herbs or gather them, and what they best combine with, and you know, they're used in a spiritual capacity as well as a physical one.
That is very, very cool, actually. I think I might want to copy.
It's worth having, actually, it's worth having one as a fantasy writer, because if you ever need something, you know, oh, I need a herb for palsy or whatever, then you just have a look through Culpepper's Complete Herbal, you can normally come up with something.
I do actually have a book of poisonous plants and then healing plants. And yeah, there is definitely some crossover.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned I suppose one of the things that you would have sort of the village handy woman or cunning woman do, certainly up until it became illegal in the 18th century, was act as an abortionist.
Yeah.
And I think I perhaps better not mention something that they would use. But again, there's a lot of crossover.
Hmm. Yeah.
And people do forget that that was only really made illegal during sort of about 1840. We've treated it like it's been an abomination for ages. And actually, no, it was always left up to women up until quickening. It was no one else's business.
Yeah, well.
So take that, pro-lifers.
Yes, that's a whole other kettle of fish that we're not going to get into right now. But it is interesting. It's interesting to see how the role of the healer has evolved if we look at sort of historical roles, and we look at the roles that we see in mythology and then finally in fiction itself and how it's changed. I think the most important thing to remember is that healer, physician, doctor, it requires a certain kind of person, and that doesn't necessarily mean that all of them are the same, but there is a quality which is needed to be able to do that job successfully. And as you say, I think that there's a little bit of weirdness needed, because it isn't within our nature to cut people up, which is why probably actually linking healers with the death is so poignant, because actually, to be honest, the same person who can stomach cutting someone up to kill them can probably stomach cutting someone up to save their life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yes. And I think we're running out of time.
Yeah, we've pretty much come to the episode here.
Well, thanks very much for listening, guys. What do you guys think? Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Who's your favourite healer? Which is your favourite doctor from which Star Trek? Just as a mention again, the dragons are now on Twitter.
Yes.
So please do check us out at Dissecting Dragons on Twitter. We will be putting out quite a bit of content. There will also be more opportunity for you guys to get involved with polls and questions, and for you guys to get in touch with us with your thoughts about different episodes. So please do come and follow us. We will follow you back. And yeah, as always, thanks very much for this.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.